Hi, everybody. This is Jeff, and I want to welcome you to the weekly podcast presented by Good News Gathering. This podcast is based on the daily Bible reading plan that the GNG family has been engaged in since the beginning of the year. It's been a tremendous time of learning for our church family, and I've heard from many of you about the impact it's having on you. One person said, "Jeff, I've tried reading through the Bible before, and I'll get started, but then I bogged down in the Old Testament. I don't understand what's going on and how it all fits together. And before long, I just quit. But doing this with the church has encouraged me to keep going. And the videos overviewing each book and the weekly podcasts have really been helpful." Let me tell you something. For a pastor, that's exactly what you hope to hear. Why? Well, it's because we know the truth found in Hebrews 4:12, and it goes like this. "For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates even to dividing soul and spirit, joints and marrow. It judges the thoughts and the attitudes of the heart." You see, the Bible is not some collection of myths and fables, made-up stories intended to convey some truth or moral principle. Now, granted, the Bible conveys both truth and moral principles, but it's a living, life-changing document. If we honestly engage with it, it works in us with the precision and incisiveness of a skilled surgeon with a scalpel. It reveals who we are and who we are not. It penetrates deep to the very core of our being, to the center of our spiritual and moral life. It discerns what is within us, both good and evil. And if we allow it, it will begin to cut away those areas of us that are infected with the disease of sin. The truth is, a surgeon's scalpel does inflict pain. And quite often, the Bible's work in us can inflict pain as well. It's painful to give up opinions, attitudes, actions, and thoughts that are sinful. It's painful for us to forgive those who have wronged us. But a surgeon's scalpel inflicts pain in the short term for the purpose of healing and wellness in the long term. And the same is true of the Bible. It may inflict pain in the short term as it does its work of cutting away the sin in our lives. But the purpose is long-term spiritual healing and wellness. Last Sunday in the atrium, I had a conversation with someone who's engaged with the Bible reading plan, and I asked if they were finding the explanatory videos helpful. This person said, "I haven't been able to figure out how to access them." Friends, if you're having any trouble getting to the videos, please contact our IT guy, Doug Puckett, at the church office. He can walk you through the process. It's quick and it's easy. At least that's what they tell me for somebody who's a technophobe. But friends, please don't miss out on the videos. They're an extremely valuable resource for helping make sense of the big picture of each book. All right, let's get down to work. If you're keeping up with the daily readings, you've finished the books of Judges and Ruth, and you're probably 20-some chapters into the book of 1 Samuel. I love the four books of Samuel and Kings because these books are teeming with leadership principles. And we'll dip into them in a big way next week. But this week, I want to go a slightly different direction. And I want to look at six Bible characters who made an impact on the storyline of the Old Testament. Six characters who, from all outward appearances, would seem unlikely to be difference makers in the world in which they live. Six characters that most people in our culture have never heard of, and who, frankly, our culture would probably be surprised to discover are even mentioned in the Bible, especially since all six of them live between 1,000 and 1,400 years before Christ. You know, there's an old adage that goes like this. If you repeat a lie often enough, people will eventually believe it's true. That's a truth, isn't it? You just keep repeating a lie, And the more you repeat it, the more people will begin to assume it's true. Why? Well, it's because most people won't take the time and effort to investigate whether it's really true or not. Most people believe what they hear, and they don't think critically. We've seen examples of this in history. Historians tell us that in Japan, prior to World War II, it only took 2 generations to convince the Japanese people that the emperor was divine, a god figure. It was a lie. And what's the result? In World War II, you had men willing to be kamikaze pilots, to fly their bomb-laden planes into American ships for the emperor. In Germany, it took less than 20 years to convince the majority of German citizens that the Jews were to blame for Germany's loss of World War I. It was a lie. And what was the result? The Holocaust. Sound familiar? In a world today dominated by the threat of radical Islamic terrorism, we should all grasp the chilling effect of lies. You see, if you repeat a lie often enough, you can convince a lot of people that it's the truth. But lies always have consequences. There's a lie that's been repeated in our culture so often that many Americans believe it to be true. And it goes like this. The Bible is misogynistic and oppressive toward women. And God, especially the God of the Old Testament, was genocidal toward everyone but his chosen people, the Israelites. Now that lie has been repeated so often, it's commonly accepted in our culture. Many Christians believe that there's some truth in it, even if they're reluctant to admit it. But lies have consequences. And this lie has resulted in the devaluing of the Bible in our culture. And that's what makes these 6 Old Testament characters so fascinating. They're all women. They all play prominent, difference-making roles. And 3 of them aren't Israelites. But 2 of them are direct ancestors of Jesus Christ. You see, if you're willing to take the time and the effort to investigate whether a commonly held belief is true, you just might find there's no truth in it at all. On last year's congregational survey, someone asked, why aren't there more books in the Bible on women? Well, you have to understand that all 5 of these women appear in the Old Testament books that we've just been reading. We find them in Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and 1 Samuel. Now, it's important to recognize the reality of the world in which these women lived. They lived over 1,000 years before Christ walked the earth. These were difficult, potentially brutal times. Women were not accorded the same status and rights as men. Many cultures of that time viewed women as property. In war, they were not viewed as people, but as spoils to be divided among the victors and used as slaves or concubines. Now, lest we think the modern world is so much more advanced, sensitive, and politically correct, let's not forget that the abuse of women has happened in the wars and conflicts of this past century. Boko Haram and ISIS have made the abuse of women calculated elements of their terrorist strategy. But the first woman I want to direct your attention to is found in Judges 4 and 5. Her name was Deborah. Here was a highly respected, multi-talented woman who rose up to lead Israel. She was a prophetess. She called the people to obey God. She was a judge. In other words, she decided disputes among the people. She was also a military leader. She led the army. As happens repeatedly in the book of Judges, the Israelites had forsaken God, and a Canaanite king named Jabin began to oppress the Israelites. Some of you are probably thinking, a Canaanite king? Weren't the Israelites supposed to drive them all out of the promised land? And the answer is yes. Joshua had defeated a previous king by that name in Joshua 11, but the Israelites had apparently failed to finish the job. And sure enough, failing to fully obey God comes back to haunt them. The Canaanites apparently regrouped, rearmed, and attempted to restore their power in Canaan. Deborah instructed Barak, the commander of the Israelite army, to fight the Canaanites, but he refused unless Deborah went with him. It's not clear why Barak refused. It's quite possible the Israelites recognized who their true leader was, and Barak understood this. Thus, he was reluctant to engage the enemy without her. Interestingly, Deborah tells Barak that the honor of victory would not belong to him. It would belong to a woman. And this brings us to the second woman, Jael. As far as we know, a Kenite, not an Israelite. And she ends up taking the life of the Canaanite commander, Sisera. Here she is, for all intents and purposes, a housewife. And she takes down the commander of an army that had been oppressing Israel for 20 years. These two women made a difference, as you can see from the last verse of Judges chapter 5, where it says, "Then the land had peace 40 years." Think about that. How would you like to know that your actions brought peace to your country for 40 years? I'd call that quite an accomplishment. Now, moving from the book of Judges to the book of Ruth, we meet two women, Naomi and Ruth. Their story begins tragically, but ends beautifully. This little book comes as a welcome relief after the repeated cycles of sin, oppression, repentance, and renewal that you find in the book of Judges. As J.D. indicated in last week's podcast, during the time of the Judges, every man did what was right in his own eyes. And as a result, Judges is filled with chaos and anarchy. And during the time of the Judges, there was a famine, and Naomi and her husband and two sons moved out of the Promised Land to the land of Moab on the east side of the Dead Sea. Naomi's sons married Moabite women. Now, this could have posed significant spiritual problems because the Moabites worshipped the false god Chemosh. Their religion involved child sacrifice. But Naomi's influence on her sons' wives appears to have been immense. Unfortunately, Naomi's husband and both sons die, leaving all these women widows. This is a horrible position for women in that era to be in. The potential for abuse was high. So Naomi determines to return to Israel, her homeland, and she implores both of her daughter-in-laws to return to their families. One does, but Ruth refuses. She states, "Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." Now, considering her background, this was a considerable leap of faith. Naomi and Ruth return to Bethlehem, but they have no means of support. Fortunately, Mosaic law provided that farmers were not to harvest their entire crop. They were to leave a portion of their crop to be picked up by the poor and foreigners. And you find this law in Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10. And that's exactly what Ruth did. She's noticed by Boaz, the owner of the fields where Ruth is gathering grain, and he not only ensures that she's safe, but that his harvesters leave her an ample portion of the crop. Naomi realizes that Boaz is her kinsman, and she instructs Ruth to approach Boaz to act as a kinsman redeemer. Now, a kinsman redeemer was a relative who volunteered to take responsibility for the extended family. When a woman's husband died, the law in Deuteronomy 25:5-10 provided that she could marry a brother of her dead husband. This seems strange to us today, but this law was meant to protect women. Women could not inherit property. Thus, if a woman's husband died, she could easily be reduced to poverty because the property passed to a son or to the nearest male relative. Naomi had no sons. They'd both died. Thus, the property owned by her husband would pass out of her hands. However, the nearest relative to a deceased husband could become a kinsman redeemer by marrying the widow and thus inheriting the land. Boaz marries Ruth, and it's just a wonderful story of people who do the right thing and the incredible blessing that comes from that. Here you have Ruth, a Moabitess, who becomes the great-grandmother of David, Israel's greatest king. And then you have Boaz. Who's his mother? She's the fifth woman who made an impact. She's none other than Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute that helped the Israelite spies at Jericho. Her story is in Joshua 2 and 6. Now, how ironic is that? King David, the greatest of the Israelite kings, his great-grandparents were a Moabite woman and a man who was half Canaanite and half Israelite. And who was King David's direct descendant? Jesus Christ. Now, the sixth woman whose life made an impact was Hannah. Her story appears in 1 Samuel chapters 1 and 2. She was married, but she was unable to have children. In that culture, despite the fact that her husband loved her, this was both crushing emotionally and stigmatizing socially. It was assumed that there was something wrong with the woman. Perhaps she was cursed by God. In an age where polygamy was practiced, it created friction between the wives. Hannah's grief over her inability to bear a child pours out in an anguished prayer to God. She vows to dedicate the child to God if only God would allow her to have a son. God grants her request, and Hannah bears Samuel. And this is where the story gets difficult. She suffered for some time with her inability to have a child, but now she has to follow through on her vow. What does that mean? The Bible indicates that after Samuel was weaned, Hannah and her husband took him to Shiloh to serve in the tabernacle. Shiloh was approximately 10 to 12 miles from her hometown of Ramah. Commentators believe Samuel was probably 3 years old when his mother and father left him at the tabernacle under the care of the priest Eli. This sounds so hard for any of us who have had children. The thought of leaving one of our children in the care of another on a full-time basis at that age is almost unthinkable. But Hannah's prayer in 1 Samuel chapter 2 gives us a glimpse into her mindset. It begins with these words, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord, my horn," which is a euphemism for strength or power, "is lifted up." She praised God for answering her prayer and giving her a son. And Samuel was a gift from God. So taking him to the tabernacle wasn't really giving him up, because he was never hers to begin with. Samuel belonged to God. There's a lesson in this story for every parent. When children are born, they are utterly dependent upon us. They can do nothing for themselves. Unfortunately, if we're not careful, we can forget that those same children will leave our homes in a few short years. It's our responsibility to train them up so they can grow toward independence in a God-honoring way. We must gradually let go of our children in order for them to become mature adults who can stand on their own. Despite the fact that Hannah was apparently not a daily presence in Samuel's life, her impact seems to have been immense. Samuel grew up to become a pivotal character in the Old Testament. He was a prophet, a judge, a priest, and God's man during a turning point in the history of Israel. He was involved in the transition of Israel from a loose confederation of independent tribes to a centralized monarchy. He was the last and most effective of Israel's judges, and he anointed Israel's first two kings. Hannah's dedication to God was reflected in her son. Could there be any greater success for any parent? Well, friends, these are the six women who made a difference. And I can't really leave this podcast without saying that here at Good News Gathering, we are blessed with a large number of highly dedicated, God-honoring women who have helped make this church what it is today. Women with amazing leadership gifts, incredible talents and abilities, visionaries, the kind of people who just naturally get something done. We're blessed by you, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to serve with you. In the words of Philippians 1:3, I thank my God every time I remember you. Friends, until next week, think biblically, think logically, and think honestly.